Welcome to another episode of Romance Romp. I'm your host, Keeney Allen. Today, I have author Marissa Stapley with me. Marissa is a Toronto-based author and journalist. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Sure, you're welcome. So first, I always like to find out a little bit about my guest as far as like their reading habits, what type of genres they read, stuff like that.
Well, I am also a book reviewer for the Globe and Mail, so I read incredibly widely just because I love to read, but I'm also always reading for work when I'm not writing, and I read very widely, but I tend to read much more fiction than nonfiction. And I tend to read widely across all genres of fiction. So, you know, I enjoy a cozy mystery. I enjoy a romance. I love Kathleen Tucker's romance and romantic suspense. I also, right now, I'm reading an advanced copy of Lauren Groff's short stories called Florida. And I love her incredible writing style, and also love short stories in general. So like Alice Munro or anything I can get my hands on. Really love Meg Wolitzer and Ann Patchett. I find lately I'm not reading very many male authors, and I don't think it's on purpose, but it's been about a year. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to have to find – actually, no, that's not true. I read Tom Perrotta's most recent one. So, okay. But I'm always reading, and a couple of books a week is usually pretty standard for me.
Okay. That's very interesting. I hardly ever read outside of romance, so I don't tend to read a lot of male authors. So I'm in the same boat with that. But it's very rare that I find somebody outside of romance that reads several books a week.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, I wonder, I think I'm such a voracious reader, and I always have been, but I do think that the romances are definitely a faster read for me. Mm-hmm. So I could probably get through like maybe, you know, two or three in a week, depending on my schedule. I write a column for the Globe that has six, it used to have six books, and now it has three, a commercial fiction column. So, okay. That was actually an overwhelming amount of reading, even for me. So I had to cut it down. Uh-huh. But my husband will always say, like, he's reading one book, and he's been reading it for about 6 months. And he's like, I've been reading this book. And meanwhile, your stack has just kept going. And I mean, I'm sure I read faster than most people. And certainly depending, you know, if I'm reading outside of romance or commercial, something more literary, you have to slow down for mm-hmm. certain things and really absorb it to go back. I do have to stop myself from kind of racing ahead, especially if something is suspenseful and I need to know what happened. Like mm-hmm. I'll just be flipping the pages and speed reading a little too much. So... you know, you have to slow yourself down sometimes.
Sure. No, I understand completely. So is there a genre that you are really drawn to?
I mean, honestly, I think it would be like sort of the kind of like a great relationship drama. And I don't even know if that's a genre. I actually have a really hard time with labeling anything. Like even like romance is straightforward. Mm-hmm. But you know, I love women's fiction. But you know, all that to say, sometimes I think, is this women's fiction because it was written by a woman? So I think I more know the kind of book I love. So no matter the genre, if it's a really juicy relationship story, and the relationship can be any kind of relationship, mm-hmm. it can be, you know, between lovers or, you know, my first novel, Mating for Life, was really a lot about a relationship between sisters and also their relationship with their mother. And I love exploring family dynamics and how who you are and what has happened to you in your childhood or your past informs how you behave in your romantic relationships. Mm-hmm. I'm really into that. I love reading that kind of thing, and I love just observing that in life mm-hmm. for use.
Sure.
for emotional scope future novels.
Yeah, no, I totally understand. And I had written down to talk to you about your book, Mating for Life, because I really love stories about sisters. So I'm definitely going to have to go back and read that. Even
yeah. Do you have sisters?
I do. I have one sister, and I talk about her all the time. Sometimes she's even on the podcast, but we're 11 years apart. I'm older. So it
Okay.
hasn't been since we are just more recently, last 5 or so years, that we've really connected on like a sister and a friend level. So I always love, I mean, of course it's fiction, but I just always, there's just something about a story with sisters in it that really pulls me in.
Well, I don't actually have sisters. So I have three brothers
Oh,
and three
wow.
stepbrothers. So possibly needless to say, I always wanted a sister. I still want a sister. And so when I started writing Mating for Life, it was actually linked. I love short stories, as I mentioned. So I just started writing short stories, and these three characters kept turning up. And my agent said to me, "You need to find a way to make those women interact with each other, because it is a book that you're writing that, you know, this if, but you need to find a way for them to meet, because they all lived in the same neighborhood, but they didn't know each other." And I kept trying to make them friends, but they were just way too different. And I kept thinking, these women would never be friends. And so then I took away their choice. I was like, oh, I can make them sisters, and then they have to have a relationship. But that was a real leap for me, because I don't know what it's like to have a sister. So I spoke to all my friends who had sisters, and I would say to them, you know, how, why is it that when you're mad at your sister, you can say whatever you want, but some, you know, if I'm mad at your sister, I can't say anything. They're like, of course you can. Just the loyalty. But I do often have people say to me, what did your sisters think of Mating for Life? And I always say, I don't, those are my sisters. Like, those characters are my fictional sisters. I don't have any. And it makes me feel really good when people say that, because I know that I got it. If people think I have sisters, then I know that I was able to really nail that relationship that I have no experience with.
Right, because it's I don't have any brothers, but I imagine it's just a very different type of relationship than one would have with a sister.
And actually, my brothers are much younger than I have. Two of my brothers are half brothers, and they're 14 and 16 years younger. So I kind of that like the relationship with you have with your sister, it's a bit of a slow burn, right? You feel almost like an aunt. And then you, as you get older, I mean, it's less complicated, but I find family dynamics are just quite complicated by their nature. So, and with blended families, there's complication there. So, but we're fine. They know I wish they were sisters, and they're good with that.
That's good. Yeah, one of the things I wrote down, and it seems like your books kind of touch on this and the things that I read about you, but kind of like family dynamics and then also that kind of like chosen family. And you just kind of touched on it a little bit. Like you said, your brothers are half brothers and family dynamics are always complicated. And I think, you know, a lot of times I can only speak for myself, but like I grew up in a complicated family. With the dynamics were always complicated. And, you know, I always thought, well, only my family is like this. It's only me. But it's not. Every family I've learned is complicated. And I use that in a
It's
very
very
nice and positive way, but it's just how families are.
And I think it's okay to be complicated. I mean, I think more and more as I get older too, you kind of, because you can go two ways as an adult. You can either decide that you're going to blame your complicated childhood, which, like you said, everybody generally has, on everything that's wrong with you, or you can sort of try to work on anything that you haven't dealt with yet, and accept your family for who they are, and choose people you have to choose. Like, I do in some ways. My half brothers and I are choosing each other, because as we don't have the same mother. We don't have that same relationship that other siblings might have. So we have to consciously try to stay tight. And they're just graduating university and starting their lives, so we're starting to make those choices now. And I think it's important, because I think people will sometimes think, oh, forget it, I'm just going to write this relationship off, it's not worth it. But I think, to me, it has to be very extreme for you to let go of your family, because family is so important, and so are friends, and so are the family that you choose. But I think it's so sad when I meet people who are like, oh yeah, I don't talk to my brother, or I don't talk to my parents or even aunts and uncles. Like it's such an effort, but yeah, I think it's important.
Oh, it's so important. Like not that long ago, my sister and I were like chatting. I mean, she lives like a mile and a half from me, but we chat all the time, like during the day and stuff. And so I was like, let's promise that even if we're mad at each other, like at some point in our lives, that we won't make, like, if you make a big decision in your life, like to move or something like that, that you'll still tell me, even if you're mad at me, you know, like, yeah. Because I don't ever want to be that type of family. I mean, of course, everybody gets mad at each other and maybe you need like a little bit of time away. But yeah, it makes me so sad. And I can't really wrap my head around the people that are like, no, I don't really get along with my family. And I'm like, what? Like, I mean,
yeah, I mean, people are so imperfect. I had a friend of my family, actually like a chosen family member, a friend of my aunt said to me once, you know, people are flawed. Like she just looked at me and she said, they just are. Everyone is flawed and we hurt each other. Mm-hmm. It's just what we do because we're not perfect. And I think about that a lot. And I think about that in my writing and in life. Like we are all flawed. And if you expect people to be perfect, then you're just going to be disappointed. And granted, like there are certainly some things that should not be forgiven. Mm-hmm. But I think a real thread in my books, especially in Things to Do When It's Raining, is the idea of forgiveness and how hard it is, but also how important it is because everybody is flawed. And I believe everybody has secrets or parts of themselves that they really have trouble revealing. And they're so afraid that when they do, they're not going to be loved. Mm-hmm. And it's just, but it's tough. Like it's easy for me to say, but you know, I'm sure there are people listening. They're like, but I can't forgive this person in my family for this. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they're like, oh yeah, people are just imperfect.
Absolutely. That's right. Absolutely. All right, so we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk more about your experience as an author, kind of how I'd like to find out more about how you transitioned to an author and more about your book that just recently released. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Wonder Book and Video connects over 2 million books with readers each year and has been serving book lovers for over 35 years. With locations in Frederick, Hagerstown, and Gaithersburg, Maryland, Wonder Book and Video is the only place you'll ever need to find your next read. And yes, Wonder Book and Video has a huge variety of romance novels from which to choose. Can't find something in the store? Check out wonderbook.com and for the month of March, get 15% off your next romance novel purchase in store or online with promo code ROMROMP. That's ROMROMP. Wonder Book and Video, a book lover's paradise. All right, so thank you for that. So before the break, you were telling me about your experience as a reader and kind of like imperfect people and families and stuff like that. And so we can talk more about your book. But before, about your book specifically, like, so how did you decide or when did you decide that you really wanted to be an author?
I always wanted to be an author. I was one of those, I really loved the author Lucy Maud Montgomery, who's a Canadian favorite. I think everyone, especially the Netflix series, has come to know Anne of Green Gables recently too. I loved those stories and I kept a journal and I loved that sort of the way she wrote. It was just so descriptive and dramatic. I really wanted to be a writer too. My grandparents were both writers. My dad is a newspaper journalist. Writing came very easily to me. I've learned a lot about writing, having gone to journalism school and, you know, done as much writing as I have, but mm-hmm. also it always came quite naturally to me. And I kind of joke now that there's nothing else I can do. I don't know how to, I've been a magazine editor, and you know, other like a waitress, like I don't have any other marketable skills. Uh-huh. So, I thought at one point before, I got a deal for Things to Do When It's Raining, things were slowing down a bit after Mating for Life. And I thought, oh my God, I might have to get a job. And the only thing this is a job, but I was going to go to school and become a librarian because I just had no idea what else I could do. And I love writing, and I truly am one of those people who I have to be writing. Mm-hmm. It is like breathing, and it's sometimes so hard. I read a quote today, something like, writing is hell and not writing is hell. And the only good place you can be in is when you have just written. It's like, it's so true. Like, once I've written for the day, I'm like, oh, I feel so good. Mm-hmm. But it's tough. It's, you know, it takes a lot out of you, but I love it. And I just always knew. And I had a few books that were failed novels before Mating for Life came out, and I just kept at it because mm-hmm. that was the only thing that I thought I could do. So I'm grateful that I can do it and yeah. that I am doing it.
That's excellent. Mm-hmm. So why specifically? I mean, you love writing. You could really write anything. So in theory, so why do you kind of stick with like this women's fiction-y type of romantic element type of story?
I mean, I think it's like, I don't actually purposely set out to write stories that are romantic, but mm-hmm. especially with Things to Do When It's Raining, it is deeply romantic in a very, very real way, in terms of like what it really like to love somebody and have that like heartbreaking lifelong love that you just can't get away from, and how tough it is day to day to make that work. Mm-hmm. I think it's just because I spend so much time thinking about relationships, and observing people's relationships and thinking about my own. Like, I drive my husband bananas with like analyzing our relationship, and because I just what I do, I'm extremely sensitive too, and I think the way that I've learned to deal with just being sensitive and empathic almost to other mm-hmm. people's emotions is just to channel it into my writing, and then it just feels better that I've gotten it kind of out, and I haven't necessarily driven someone I know and love completely nuts with my analysis of mm-hmm. of them. I can just sort of create these people who mm-hmm. who I can analyze all I want, and their feelings don't get hurt.
Sure.
I answered the question. That's all I think about. I think about relationships and people all the time.
I understand. Like, if you could see me, I'm like hardcore nodding my head. I'm super sensitive. I like overthink and analyze all the people all the time. It's like my hobby. Yeah. It's my hobby that nobody knows about. What was
my
that?
I see that my daughter is the same, and it hurts me sometimes to look at her and to see her feeling everything on everybody else's behalf. And mm-hmm. her teachers will say, well, of course they have these character awards at school. And she, of course, I saw that there was an empathy award, and I thought, if she doesn't get the empathy award, then these awards are just stupid. Mm-hmm. And of course she got it like every year, because she's constantly looking at other people and seeing how they feel, and but also trying to fix it. And, you know, it's mm-hmm. just, there's so many ways that you can go wrong being empathetic, and then eventually you start to try to deal with it by doing things like writing, or she does a lot of art. And, mm-hmm. It's just, I think, and it's nice, you know, when you've met somebody who's that way, but then it's so hard sometimes to be around other people who aren't. Mm-hmm. I don't understand, and I'm sure you're the same, how other people don't think about the way other people feel as deeply as we do, mm-hmm. and get so caught up in it. But right. That's not actually like a normal thing.
Right. It just seems, to us, it's normal. So I get it. So,
right.
So What to Do When It's Raining was released in February. So congratulations for that. So can you give me a brief synopsis?
So it's a multi-generational love story at its center is a young woman named Mae Summers, mm-hmm. Who was raised by her grandparents after her parents died in an accident on the St. Lawrence River. And at the beginning of the novel, she has lost everything. Her fiancé has turned out to be a con artist, and she's been living in New York City and having this great life, but it's all just fallen apart. So she has no choice but to return home to the little tourist town where she was raised by her grandparents, at a bed and breakfast beside the river. And at the same time, her childhood friend and the love of her life, Gabriel, has also been drawn back to their hometown. And Mae's grandparents are in their 80s, and they're declining, and they are having huge problems with their relationship. It's about these characters finding their way back to one another. Mm-hmm. And it's extremely hard for them to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it. And one of the things that I wrote down that, you know, I see this a lot. And for you, how for writing, you know, when you want it to be kind of rooted in realism and have some real issues that real people might face, like, how do you write that without it being like too real? Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I don't think I do. I think sometimes maybe it is a little too real. Like, okay. I really go there with, like, I think it is real. Like, it feels, and I think so there are, you know, people are like, I just had a review, I think it was the Book Reporter who said, I don't recall ever encountering more real three-dimensional characters. Okay. Some people might write, like, in their reviews, I was so frustrated with these characters. They were making these mistakes, and I just was so mad at them. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't like them, and then I realized they're real people. They're truly flawed, like, real characters who do things that real people might do and feel the way real people feel. And I find myself in my writing, if I'm writing a scene, and especially if it's an emotionally difficult thing or something bad has happened, and sometimes the writing will start to sound a little hollow and forced, and I'll have to just stop and maybe even go for a walk and really think about how I would feel in that situation. And it involves thinking about really difficult things, like, how would I feel if my parents had died when I was young, like May, and I didn't really know them, you know, what would that really feel like, and what would that do to me as an adult, and how would I then be so, like, and that's why I think May is so afraid of losing people, and she's constantly sort of like, oh my God, what if I lose you too, and that's kind of her cross to bear. And also with the grandparents, how would it really feel? I mean, we all have grandparents who have lived through a war. Most of us do, or I guess in my generation. But how would that really feel to live during a war and to have, like in George's case, to have gone off and fought in a war and lost a friend? And how does that feel? Like, what does that really, really do to you? And then when you come home, what is the reality for you? It just involves a lot of thought and a lot of crying when I think about it.
Oh, I'm sure. You know, and I write it out. Yeah. And I think you had kind of touched on like the flawed and imperfect, you know, people. And for me, one of the things that I'm frequently drawn to in a book is feeling like I'm reading characters that are flawed and imperfect because I'm a human and I am flawed. And even though it's fiction, I feel like it also brings a little bit of that, like, okay, if these fictional characters who are flawed and imperfect are working through their things, you know, perhaps me as a real human can also work through mine.
Yeah, I think it's important. I mean, it's nice to have escapist fiction, and I'm sure I enjoy just not having to think too much when I'm reading certain, depending on where I am. But I also think we should learn. Part of why I love reading so much is because I think we can learn so much from it. And I think it's kind of great when you can learn from a fictional character or learn about your own life in your reading life. And learn about it in a way where you don't actually have to go through it, or you can process something and maybe something that you identify with in your own life and you're reading, and it's fiction and you're caught up in the story, but you're also like, oh yeah, I felt that way before. Someone I know felt that way. And isn't that interesting? Like, capturing that universal experience is important to me. And I love reading authors who can do that, but I do also love just sometimes taking a break from the, the emotional heaviness of my own writing and just kind of, escaping into something that characters are perfect.
Absolutely.
I don't have to worry about
that. Yeah, sometimes I do want to just read that everybody's perfect, everybody likes each other, they fall in love or they figure it out and it's done, and that's great and it has a purpose, and you know, there's nothing wrong with that. So one of the things that it seems like kind of runs in both of your books so far is there tend to be some like family secrets. And I think, again, even though these are fictional things, I think that's something that's probably pretty common in, you know, real life too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the whole story was actually inspired by, a sort of a family secret, like an open secret that was in my family that came out after my grandmother died. And I really missed her. So I was creating the Lily character, trying to have her with me. And I really had to let that go and allow Lily to be funny, because Lily had to in order to become a flawed character who would make mistakes and keep the story going and in motion. Because that's the one thing, if you don't have flawed characters who are, you know, making mistakes or going down different paths, it's kind of tough to get a story going with all that interesting. I had to stop making her like my grandmother, who, as far as I was concerned, was perfect, and let her just be Lily. But the entire premise of the story did have its roots in the fact that my grandmother had been married, and my mom's dad actually was a man who had died in a workplace accident when my mom was really young, and then she remarried the man who I knew as my grandfather. But nobody talked about this first husband. And even now, like, my uncles, we were talking about it at Christmas because this book coming out has made everyone talk about it. They knew, but they didn't know his name. They actually didn't know his name. And my mom was like, my father's name was Lawrence. Like, that was his name. And these people are in their 60s. Like, they've never talked about. And I just think that's so interesting, just keeping these secrets your whole life. Like, I'm not great at keeping secrets. So I don't know how they do it. But it makes for a good story. That's great storytelling, is keeping secrets until that kind of last minute when you reveal everything. So,
Yeah, anytime I think about secrets, I'm not sure if you've heard of this. It's like an internet thing, site project, if you will. It's called Post Secret, where people mail in their secrets anonymously. And the curator, he posts them every week. And so I saw him speak probably 3 years ago locally. And one of the things that he said, I don't think it's specific to him, but it has always stuck with me. And it's secrets are the currency of intimacy. So
that's interesting.
Yeah. And kind of how, like, the secrets we keep, and there's all different types of secrets, and we keep them for many different reasons or whatever. And, you know, it varies across person to person and everything. But it's also like the secrets we keep, it kind of, we kind of hold ourselves back from other people, I think. You know, and a lot of it is like a protection mechanism, defense mechanism and stuff like that. But still, anytime I think about secrets, I always think about that and how it really resonated with me.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting. Actually, all I can think is, like, that to be a great site to get book ideas. Yes. Just to go look at people's secrets. But it's true. And it can go two ways also, because you can tell everything to someone and in the hopes also that they'll just love you anyway, and almost alienate yourself from them by just telling them too much. And I think there is a line in Things to Do When It's Raining that is something Lily is saying, you know, everyone has some secrets are meant to be told and some aren't. And the trick in life is just figuring out which one is which. Like, there's something to be said for not telling all your secrets.
Right.
Knowing some things are just going to cause too much pain. And it's not necessarily good to have everything out in the open. And it is, it's such a balancing act. That is the trick of life. And I think that website's so interesting, because maybe some people have gotten things off their chest that would not benefit anyone in their lives. If they knew, and maybe it just, there's something about confession. I don't know if it's a religious thing or what. People love it.
Well, yeah. I mean, and the thing I think about Post Secret, because it is anonymous, you can kind of, like, if you have this secret that's, like, you're carrying the burden of it and you don't want to tell anybody else because it's not going to accomplish anything, or maybe it makes things worse, or I don't even know. There's lots of different things. You can send it off and, yeah, like you said, kind of like confessional, and be done with it and be like, all right, I've unburdened myself, even if nobody knows that I've unburdened myself. Yeah, I was thinking about something, but of course it's already gone from my mind. So you okay, so I saw the notes that you have that column, Shelf Life. And I found the one article that you read, I think early in February, about kids and what your kids will think about you and the books that you've written. And I really enjoyed that article.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I enjoyed writing it.
Yeah.
I kept asking my kids, like, want to read my books? You want to read it now? Are you going to read my book?
Yeah, that must be, you know, and you mentioned like, will your son, because it's kind of like a women's fictiony type book, like will your son not feel like he can read it, or if your daughter will feel like, you know, maybe she's, I'm paraphrasing here, but like maybe above reading it or something like that. And so, yeah. You know, and not a lot of people talk about those types of things. So good for you.
Yeah, I do. I talk about it a lot. I mean, you can really do your head in by obsessing over genre and labeling and the way women or authors are treated compared to males and that kind of thing. But I do, it does bother me a bit because I don't, everything I write, I believe that men can enjoy it just as much as women, and I really think it's just about how it's marketed. Mm-hmm. And we're kind of told that this is for you and this is for you, and I think men would really benefit from reading more about relationships. I always think like men are like, well, I don't understand women, and and I just think to myself, well, if you read the books that we read, and particularly more fiction, you probably would understand. And even, you know, reading romances, and you'd understand more about romance and what women really want. Mm-hmm. Like if every guy had to read, you know, a really popular romance, and then that would be like that, you know, movie, What Women Want, like he would actually know, and it wouldn't have to be Mel Gibson. Like every guy could just know.
Yeah.
What a woman wants and what makes women feel loved and what they think is sexy. And, I think it's a shame that for some reason we don't allow that. But I do feel hopeful that it's getting better, and with this generation and the next one, it'll be a bit less everything gender labeled.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. I think we're definitely slowly making strides against it. You know, with you know, as simple as like trying to not be so gender specific on toys. You know, and stuff like that. And so I'm even trying to get away from even using the term women's fiction as much, but it's just so recognizable that, you know, it's just fiction, really. Why does it have to be women's fiction? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, even between when Mating for Life came out and now with Things to Do When It's Raining, when Mating for Life came out, people would say, what do you write? And I would say fiction, stubbornly. Mm-hmm. And they would say, what kind of fiction? Is it romance? Is it women's fiction? Is it this? And then I would say, well, it's women's fiction. Mm-hmm. And now I decided when Things to Do When It's Raining came out, I didn't want to have that conversation or battle. And I would just say it's women's fiction. Mm-hmm. And more than once, a reader or a friend or someone has said to me, oh, well, why does it have to be women's fiction? Why can't it just be fiction? And I'm like, I don't know. I've been asking myself that for years.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, stuff is going on right now in the world that means that people are thinking about why something is called women's fiction, and it's not, the burden doesn't fall to the authors to be grappling with this labeling. Consumers are finally saying, why is this labeled this way? Why can't I just be reading fiction? Why does this have to have a pink cover? Why? And then that's when things might start changing, with the consumer actually noticing and maybe being perplexed by their reading being labeled.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. But I mean, and I think we're slowly getting there. And, you know, specifically with romance, I think more and more mainstream outlets are covering romance and making it more less of a like the stigma surrounding it as to like what it is, who's rating it, stuff like that. And, you know, my own little pie in the sky is I hope that that's going to start to kind of bleed over all the different genres. You know, like women can read whatever they want. It doesn't have to have a pink cover on it. Men can read whatever they want, even if it has a pink cover on it. You know, like just let people read.
Yeah, exactly. Things to Do When It's Raining came out in Germany, actually before it came out in North America. And the publisher's tagline, translated from German for the book and all the promotional stuff they did, was the world needs more love stories. And I just thought, you know, it's so true. Always. We always need love stories.
Mm-hmm.
It's we humans, we seek each other out. And and our relationships are a huge part of our life, whether we accept that or not. And I don't think that women are less, are more focused on relationships than men. I just think we know how to talk about it. And mm-hmm. in part, I think that's because we read about it. Mm-hmm. And again, that going back to my point of, you know, you can learning from your reading life, and applying that to your real life is a great thing. And I do hope that everyone, male and female, feels more comfortable in the future to do, mm-hmm. to do that.
No, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. So what's next for you?
So my agent just announced my third novel is called The Last Resort, and mm-hmm. so it will be coming out in Canada, the United States, and Germany next year. So The Last Resort is actually about two couples who go to a couples counseling retreat in Tulum, Mexico, where not everything is as it appears. Mm-hmm. So there are secrets and lies and passions, and the couples counseling retreat is run by a couple, this marriage counseling power couple, who seem perfect on the surface and seem to have the relationship that everyone wants, but they really don't, and mm-hmm. things go seriously awry when the male marriage counselor goes missing.
Oh, wow.
And so yeah, so it's actually really a lot of fun because it's got these deep relationship dynamics, and there's romance, and there's all of that stuff that I love, but this layering of the mysterious disappearance, mm-hmm. It's been compared to Big Little Lies, and it's exciting. I'm enjoying writing it a lot, and I'm very excited about it because I think it has a lot of crossover potential mm-hmm. across many different genres.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it, yeah. So, yeah. So that will probably another year before okay. that one's out.
Yeah, I think I saw a little bit of mm-hmm. a blurb about that maybe on your website. And I find it interesting because I think a lot of times, even in romance or kind of more mainstream women-y fiction, I see a lot of either couples coming together or couples breaking apart. But I don't see a lot of like couples who are together and are saying like something's not working. Maybe we need to try to fix this. So that doesn't sound like that's the whole scope of the, but it sounds like that's kind of what gets those couples to maybe perhaps to say like, hey, maybe we can work on something better and end up at this, you know, resort for counseling.
Yeah, no, and I'm really obsessed with marriage dynamics and the romance that can happen in a marriage, mm-hmm. But also just, you know, what can happen inside a marriage when it's really fractured. And I think a lot of people, I mean, marriage is hard. It's really, really. And I don't trust people who say it isn't because I don't think they're telling the truth, because within every marriage, I believe that there is, you know, a secret like what Lily and George had in Things to Do When It's Raining. And that secret either has to do with what makes the marriage work, or that secret has to do with why that marriage is destined to fail. Mm-hmm. And I could write about marriage, I think, forever. This is definitely not. Mating for Life had a lot to do with marriage, and this one does. And I just think there's so much material, mm-hmm. but also that can be very romantic, like finding your way back to your spouse after you think that everything is lost is, I would say, 100 times more romantic than the first love, kind of first blush of new love and romance. And it's very easy to be in love with someone when you don't know them very well. Mm-hmm. And it's very too, when you sleep beside them every night and they're snoring and driving you crazy. And if you can find romance and love in that, that is really beautiful and deeply romantic. Mm-hmm.
No, that's what it seems like to me. I'm not married, but I, you know, from a lot of the fiction I read and the stories that I hear from my friends and stuff like that, I mean, I feel like it does take a lot of work to stay married. And I joke sometimes with my reader group, you know, because they'll be kind of like, I'm using the term very loosely, complaining about their spouses. And I'm like, man, you guys are really selling this whole marriage thing, you know, just joking. But also, like, I know that, like, it's not always that first love, that first easy, you know, that first couple of years or whatever, where you're still behaving very nicely. And after a while, people, you know, sometimes we behave poorly. And how do you reconcile absolutely. That, you know, to maintain long term?
It's tough, and I think, well, I'm almost 40, and I think, we all of my friends are in the same stage right now. We love our husbands, but we've had our kids, and the biological thing is not really happening. And it's everybody is really in a relationship transition, and this is literally the time in your life where you have to choose to love your spouse. You either choose to do it or you choose not to, and it quite simply is a choice. And and I do. I write that isn't every that was in Mating for Life. That concept is in Things to Do When It's Raining, and again in The Last Resort. I just that's my kind of pet story seed is just this idea of coming apart and then coming together again.
Yeah, I like that kind of theory, so I'm definitely going to make sure I look for that, the Last Resort book as well. And yeah, so that was really about all I had for you today, Marissa. I really appreciate you chatting with me, and I'll link to your site so that listeners are able to find out more about you. And if they're interested in the book, find it at the e-tailer of their choice. But yeah, so again, I thank you for taking the time to chat with me today.
Okay, thank you so
All
much.
right, thanks.
Okay, all right.
Bye. Romance Romp is produced by Graham Cullen and me. Music by Kelsey Luce. Stay tuned for next week's episode for an interview with author Susan Bishop Crispell. And again, thank you to Wonderbook and Video for their sponsorship.